I'm Shamita Basu, in for Tanzina Vega, who's on maternity leave, and this is The Takeaway. Last week, a coronavirus conspiracy video called Plandemic was released online. It's filled with inaccurate information and advice that goes against just about everything medical experts have told the public about COVID-19. In the nearly 30-minute video, Judy Mikovits, a discredited research scientist, espouses a number of conspiracy theories against Dr. Anthony Fauci, multiple public health agencies, vaccines, and she refutes the benefits of masks, of washing your hands, and of social distancing.
Why would you close the beach? You've got sequences in the soil, in the sand. You've got healing microbes in the ocean, in the salt water. That's insanity.
That's a clip from Plandemic, in which Mikovits tells viewers that beaches should have remained open during the pandemic for unscientific reasons that experts say have no basis in fact. Science Magazine actually did a big fact check on Mikovits recently, and we have that linked on our website for you to check out yourself. Still, the video apparently struck a chord with many Americans, and within days, it had been watched tens of millions of times, and Mikovits' book became a bestseller on Amazon. YouTube and Facebook have taken the video down because of its falsehoods, but its massive spread came at a moment when getting clear, accurate health information to the public was crucial, and the spread of misinformation at a time like this can be costly. We've got two people on the line to discuss the spread of misinformation around COVID-19 and why it matters. Emily Vraga is an associate professor in the Hubbard School of Journalism and Mass Communication at the University of Minnesota. Thank you for being here, Emily.
Thank you for having me.
And Daniel Funke, a staff writer covering online misinformation for PolitiFact. It's good to have you here too, Daniel.
Hi, thanks for having me.
So, Emily, how do you and your colleagues define misinformation?
So, misinformation is probably best categorized as information that is considered accurate based on the best available evidence from relevant experts at the time.
Mm-hmm. And Daniel, I know that you've been tracking COVID-related misinformation for PolitiFact. What trends have you noticed emerging at different points in this pandemic?
Yeah, so early on in the pandemic, in January, February, we saw a lot of conspiracy theories and hoaxes about the source of the virus. So this is misinformation about the virus being created in the lab or being created as a bioweapon. Mm-hmm. And then from there, it kind of evolved into misinformation about cures and treatments for the virus as people started to take it seriously. And now we're seeing the rise of political misinformation about the virus. So trying to peg it to a certain political party or trying to link financial connections to certain politicians.
And how do you identify what is misinformation? Like, how do you decide which misinformation is actually worth fact-checking?
Yeah, so every single day I scroll through hundreds of social media posts and try to decide which ones I want to cover. And we look at a couple of different things. So first, we want to see if there is a fact-checkable claim. So we see a lot of social media posts that are salacious or hyperpartisan, but we're always looking to see if we can judge it based on some preconceived set of evidence, whether it's data or just other evidence that we can find online. And then secondly, we want to make sure that that post has reached enough people that it is worth covering, because at PolitiFact, we don't want to reintroduce people to misinformation that they might not have seen before. So we look at things like how many times a post has been shared or liked or commented on. And there's no right answer here or number that we use to justify our fact check, but we use those as signals to determine whether or not we pursue something. And then finally, we always want to make sure that our readers are asking us about it. So at PolitiFact, we have really engaged readers who will send us DMs or emails asking us to look into certain social media posts or claims. And we assume that if we've received one email from a reader about a certain piece of content, there are probably dozens of other readers who had the same question but didn't reach out to us.
And are there specific characteristics that you tend to find in misinformation that goes viral?
Yeah, so the most viral misinformation often taps into something that broad population is wondering about, right? So with Plandemic, it is a polished version of the conspiracy theories that we see every single day online. It answers some of the biggest questions that people have right now about the coronavirus pandemic. One of the frustrating things about misinformation, especially during a pandemic, is that oftentimes the answer is we don't know, or researchers are still looking into this, or there's no evidence to back this up. And that's most of the falsehoods that are made in Plandemic. So this kind of misinformation is really appealing to people that want answers about something that is really complicated, like a infectious disease that has recently emerged. But that stuff is often false or unsupported, and it goes viral really quickly on social media.
Emily, I'm thinking about past public health crises. Does the misinformation that's being shared right now about COVID-19 look similar or follow any similar trends to misinformation that was shared in the past?
Yes, and I think Daniel explained exactly why that would be. People are looking for answers that science just can't necessarily give us. I also think people are looking for solutions that science can't necessarily give us yet, or that are really hard. No one particularly likes social distancing. And the difficulties created by that, it would be much easier to believe that, you know, simply putting pepper in your food or gargling water or any of these other kind of false cures that we see online are effective than I have to, you know, distance myself from all my loved ones. So I think that the characteristics that make us want to believe misinformation are really similar across different kind of diseases. And so, yeah, I think there's a lot of similarities between the kinds of misinformation we're seeing now versus what we saw earlier.
And Emily, is there any way of measuring COVID-19 misinformation and the spread of misinformation with real life health consequences?
I think that that's an especially important characteristic to think about is a lot of misinformation doesn't have necessarily any consequence. So I mentioned the WHO has debunked this idea that putting hot pepper in your food is going to prevent or cure COVID. Now, if I believe that and I don't take appropriate precautions, then it does have really problematic consequences. If I'm still washing my hands and social distancing, a little extra pepper in my food is probably not going to affect me one way or the other. So I think separating out those kinds of misinformation that have consequences versus those that are perhaps a little less consequential is important to do. That being said, of course, the things we think affect the things we do. And so if you believe something that's untrue, you might act in ways that are not ideal.
Daniel, what responsibility do social media companies have to stop the spread of misinformation on their platforms? And what are they actually doing so far?
Yeah, so for a long time, social media companies like Facebook have kind of abdicated some responsibility when it comes to misinformation, right? Saying that they don't want to be an arbiter of truth and they don't want to remove false content, but would rather leave it up to the community to decide. With the pandemic, we have seen a lot of social media companies take a harder line when it comes to misinformation. The reason why is because a lot of health misinformation can have direct or dire consequences. So take, for example, the false claim that drinking bleach cures the coronavirus. This is a really dangerous claim that could lead to hospitalizations and even death in some cases. So we saw Facebook, Twitter, and YouTube take down claims that actually relate to this, because they go against their community guidelines, you know, wanting to avoid harmful misinformation. So we have seen some of the tech companies take hard lines when it comes to misinformation that could directly cause a harm like that. Now, when you get to a gray area is when you get to political misinformation, right? So Facebook doesn't really want to touch false claims made by politicians. And that's an interesting policy choice, but it does show that there are still gaps in their policies.
Emily, I'm thinking about just the rest of us who are on these social media platforms. And when we see others sharing misinformation, what's the best way for us to respond? And I'm thinking of this happening in two ways. There's the posts that you see by people that you don't really know well, that you, I don't know, went to high school with and you're not really in touch with. And then there's the people who are posting who you're actually close to or that who you're related to. What's the right way to respond?
So I've been doing research on this topic with Dr. Letitia Bodie from Georgetown University for a number of years, and the answer is respond. There's a lot of evidence that when you correct somebody on social media, you can do a benefit for the entire community seeing that interaction. Mm-hmm. So the person sharing the misinformation might be the hardest one to reach. They're the ones who were convinced enough of something that they're willing to share it. But everyone else, they're a step removed and might be more easily corrected. The other thing to point out is this is actually happening quite often. So we did a survey at the end of March, and we found that about a third of Americans said they had seen someone else being corrected on social media in the past week related to COVID-19. And even more importantly, people tended to like that kind of behavior. They said it was part of the public's responsibility, or that, you know, explicitly that they like it when people are correcting others. So it's not something that people tend to, it might not always be comfortable, but it is something people tend to appreciate.
But what happens when the social media users are put in the position of being the editors of what's on those platforms? I mean, it, not only can it be exhausting for some people to constantly be trying to correct misinformation, is that really the most effective way for people to be on these platforms with each other?
It certainly can be exhausting. And I'm not saying you have to fact check every single claim you see, but if you see somebody sharing something you know to be false, the best thing you can do is reply with the accurate information and provide a link to some kind of expert source. And that could be the CDC, that could be your local health company, it could be a news media organization that you trust. So making sure people have that accurate information. And again, it's not necessarily about the person sharing the misinformation. We want to update them. We want to make sure they have the correct information. That can actually become a difficult sell. Mm-hmm. But it's about everyone else who sees that post. You don't want them left with an inaccurate impression of what the evidence is right now. And so finding ways to do that when you see misinformation, correcting it, makes social media a better place for everyone.
Mm-hmm. Emily, what do you think is the responsibility of the social media companies in these cases to combat misinformation? Daniel talked a little bit about what kinds of actions have been taken by, so far by Twitter or by Facebook, but do we know what's actually effective?
So we know that some of these types of steps can be affected. So Facebook's related stories algorithm, where they show fact checks after you share misinformation, has been shown to reduce misperceptions among people seeing those misinformation stories. Other steps they can take is trying to, again, make it more difficult to see that misinformation, making it clear that there is more accurate information, so that when you give people something that's misinformation, but you also give them something that's accurate, most people are going to take that accurate information instead. But it's making sure that they have that accurate information there at that exact same point in time.
Daniel, PolitiFact has found a number of statements that President Trump has made about COVID-19 to be false or mostly false. What's the best way to combat misinformation when it comes directly from the president?
Yeah, so this was a tough one, right? Because President Trump, as opposed to some social media users, has arguably the biggest pulpit in the world by which he can make claims. At PolitiFact, we take the approach that it is best to just call him out every time there is a falsehood being uttered on national television. So we will retweet or tweet our fact checks over and over again. Some people say that this isn't enough to correct the president. But fact checkers like PolitiFact believe that we just want to put as much credible information in front of people as possible. Our goal isn't necessarily to get the president to change his mind, right? But we want the American people to know, hey, the president is saying this during the coronavirus press briefings, and it's not actually true, or it's half true, or here's some context you need. So that's something we're doing, and I think a lot of journalists could do that. And if you're someone watching the president during a coronavirus press briefing and you hear something interesting, or you go, hey, is that true? Just do a quick Google search. Oftentimes that'll turn up plenty of press coverage that contextualizes what you're seeing.
And Emily, aside from trying to correct bad information that people see on social media, on their friends' posts, what can people do to avoid sharing or amplifying misinformation? What should they be looking for?
I think what Daniel said is actually the best thing that you can do is don't try necessarily to just look at a piece of information and decide within the context of that article, is this true or not? Plandemic looks very professionally done. You have somebody who has the title of doctor, but as soon as you do some searching, you'll see all of the problems with that content. There are fake news websites that try to look like real news websites that mimic the things that we look for, but Googling or looking for their names elsewhere can give you really important cues about whether or not that source can be trusted. So taking that extra 30 seconds to search and look for that information that seems too good to be true or just seems outlandish can really help you discover whether other people have already kind of debunked that information and prevent you from sharing something that's false.
Mm. Emily, you know, I'm sort of struggling with some of my family members, older family members, who may not be very tech savvy, who don't spend a lot of time necessarily on the internet, and who have sometimes been sending me some things that are full of misinformation, especially at a moment like this. How do I advise my family members on how to navigate information at a time like this?
That's really hard. You're not just asking them to think carefully about the information they're seeing, but learn a whole new set of skills. The idea of opening a new tab and searching for something is second nature for a lot of people, but for others, they might not know what exactly that means. So I think that understanding where people are and showing a lot of empathy is a really important first step. And then back to trying to get them to search for things. There's a lot of fantastic fact-checking happening. A lot of people are doing their best to make sure the high-quality information is available. It just involves us taking that time to go an extra step and not just retweet something that seems totally true to us. It matches what we feel in our gut, but actually matches reality.
Emily Vraga is an associate professor at the University of Minnesota, and Daniel Funke is a staff writer covering online misinformation for PolitiFact. Thank you, both of you.
Thank you.
Thanks so much for having me.
NYC Now delivers the most up-to-date local news from WNYC and Gothamist every morning, midday, and evening. With 3 updates a day, listeners get breaking news, top headlines, and in-depth coverage from across New York City. By sponsoring programming like NYC Now, you'll reach our community of dedicated listeners with premium messaging in an uncluttered audio experience. Visit sponsorship.wnyc.org to get in touch and find out more.